Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. You'll need to know on news and politics 7 days a week. I'm Ros Taylor. I'm frankly surprised that today's guest is here at all. As a lawyer, he's worked for people whose attempts to stand up to state corruption have ended in their deaths. David Hooper is now retired, but has written a book called Buying Silence about the way oligarchs, companies and plutocrats use the law to gag their opponents. Robert Maxwell, Yevgeny Prigozhin, Nadim Zahawi, Mohammed Al-Fayed, it's a rogues gallery of the evil, the corrupt and the merely tax shy. Welcome to The Bunker, David.
Good morning.
Your book is about SLAPs, which stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. Who was the first person to launch a SLAP?
Well, it really started with Goldsmith because he issued some 90 writs against Private Eye. And the other thing he did, which was particularly pernicious and was an example for other people to follow later, was that he said, if you sell this offending material in bookshops, you will be sued too.
So let's just rewind. Goldsmith, we're talking about Sir James Goldsmith, who was the founder of the Referendum Party. And what was he suing about?
He was basically suing because they were saying that he was unfit to run public companies. And also, the thing that had really upset him was that he was being accused of organising the protection of Lord Lucan, who had murdered his nanny in mistake for his wife.
Lord Lucan is a story that just keeps on giving. It's one that I've written about a couple of times in my career, and it's extraordinary. If you don't know it, I recommend you read about it. So Goldsmith was the first, but he very much was not the last. Most of us know that London has become a laundromat for dodgy Russian money since the 1990s. And we do, after all, have the owner of the Evening Standard, who's the son of a Russian oligarch sitting in the House of Lords, on the rare occasions when he bothers to turn up there, that is. What's perhaps less well known is how Russian oligarchs have used English courts to silence their critics. Why are they able to do this, David?
Well, the courts seem to take the view that the fact that they're rich shouldn't be held against them, that it's they seem to take the view that it's not their fault that they're oligarchs. And they are just too accommodating. They look for any residual libel. And the problem is, the longer the case goes on and the more money that is spent, it means that everyone drops out. And of course, the other thing that happens is that it means that everyone else stops reporting about these cases. It's a very pernicious process. And of course, a lot of them are doing it for sort of ulterior motives. They're trying to launder their reputation. Some of them think that if they can get a verdict in their favour, they might get sanctions against them lifted. And the extraordinary thing is that a number of these people had served serious prison sentences in Russia. The whole process is pretty scandalous. It needs resetting. The courts need to consider whether it's really right that these cases go ahead.
And yet they're allowed to sue in England on quite flimsy pretexts often, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, some of the cases that have gone ahead, the courts should have intervened at a much earlier stage. The courts do intervene eventually, but in the case litigation concerning Bill Browder, the American financier who operated in Russia till he was effectively thrown out of Russia. That case should never have been allowed to proceed for as long as it did. It was no fault of the judge, but the procedure meant that about 500,000 at least had been spent on each side before eventually the case was thrown out. It may have been nearer a million because these cases are unbelievably expensive.
And presumably it creates a bit of a circle where the easier it is to sue in the UK and the more likely the case is to be successful, the more oligarchs and plutocrats then decide to do that themselves. And one of the people who did this, quite astonishingly in my view, was Yevgeny Prigozhin. Now, listeners will know that he's the man who died in a plane crash in August, coincidentally perhaps after abandoning a coup against Vladimir Putin, or not. He sued a British journalist, I believe, for saying that he was associated with the Wagner Group.
Associated with the Wagner Group, about which 6 months later he boasted that he had actually founded it and he was successful. And he also sued in respect of running something called the Internet Research Agency, which was a body that had sent thousands and thousands of troll messages, which it's thought helped Trump win the 2016 election. And again, subsequently, he boasted of having done that. And yet there were plenty of lawyers who were quite happy to represent him. And I mean, he was by that stage indicted, he had been sanctioned. And yet once the rubles were put on the table, the people were perfectly happy to act for them. It was an absolute scandal.
How was this case allowed to proceed, given that, you know, we know that he was involved in the Wagner Group? It seems self-evident. And yet, was it completely baseless?
The case was completely and utterly baseless. The lawyers have gone to great lengths to say, as indeed is the case, that they were permitted under the rules to do it. And what was extraordinary was that under the rules as they were then interpreted by a Treasury body called OFSI, they actually allowed money to be paid so that his lawyers could fly out in luxury to St. Petersburg to see him. Now, those rules have stopped. And it was again a case where a lot of money had to be spent. Ultimately, the judge would have thrown it out. But of course, by that stage, there would still have been a massive amount of money spent. And it was really only because Elliot Higgins of Bellingcat was supported by his lawyers charging very low rates and other people assisting, but they were able to go on. And of course, again, these cases are the tip of the iceberg, because what you don't know is under the surface, there are all stories that are not getting published because the media, contrary to what people think, don't have unlimited funds nowadays.
No, very much not. And what was the outcome of the Prigozhin legal case? I mean, he's dead now, obviously, so he cannot sue anymore. But what was the situation with Elliot Higgins?
Well, in the end, his lawyers applied to come off the record before there was an application to strike out. That case, for some curious reason, was held in private. So we don't know exactly why they came off the record. But I think there was also a suspicion that the lawyers were a little bit worried that they weren't going to get paid in future, which may have motivated their application to come off the record. So eventually the judge threw the case out because he said there was no point it going on. But by that time it had still caught, and Bellingcat's a very small not-for-profit organisation.
And which was the firm that was involved in, which was the firm representing Prigozhin in this case?
It was a very small firm that I personally had not heard of before called Discreet Law. And
right.
They were hired by a large Moscow law firm.
Certain firms are more associated with these kinds of actions than others, aren't they? Which British firms do tend to act for oligarchs?
Well, Carter Ruck is certainly one of them, and Olswang is another one, and Mishkon de Rea. And of course, there are two sides to this argument. I mean, I think it's going to be more difficult for them to act in future because the solicitor's regulatory authority has really tightened up on what is appropriate conduct has a lot of aggressive practices that have been used in the past are now not going to be permitted, and people may run into. But at the time they did them, they were perfectly lawful, and they weren't breaking any laws. And of course, from the oligarch's point of view, they too want a Rottweiler rather than a cockapoo. They want aggressive lawyers, and in firms like Olswang, Carter Ruck, and Michigan Durea, they get it in spades.
Presumably, it's more difficult now as well with the rules that were introduced after the Russia invaded Ukraine. Does that impact on whether you can pay lawyers easily?
Well, I think the Treasury realised that they had made a great mistake in allowing these cases to go on. And in fact, they had really made it Liberty Hall. They were saying, well, really, you don't need permission. If you're only going to spend £1 million on fees, you don't need our permission. Now that they've done a U-turn on that, the rule now is going to be that for libel actions are not normally going to be a permitted purpose. So oligarchs probably are not going to be able to sue till the Ukraine war is sorted out. But there are plenty of others who are not sanctioned, and there are plenty in Europe, whether it's Sweden, Germany, or wherever.
And it's not just oligarchs who use slaps to pursue their interests. Listeners will remember Nadim Zahawi, the MP for Stratford-upon-Avon, who had a number of cabinet roles at different times. He was briefly Chancellor, and he accepted that job, even though he was fined by HMRC. How did he try to keep this quiet?
Well, he just set two firms of lawyers on to try and silence this tax lawyer who was exposing the fact that he was being investigated, and that he was in the curious position of being in charge of the investigation into his own tax avoidance. And in fairness to those lawyers, it does appear that Mr. Zahawi was a little economical in the truth in the instructions he gave, because they were very competent lawyers. I mean, he must have known that he was being investigated, because he had spent several months agreeing to pay $5 million, and rich as he is, I think even Mr. Zahawi would notice a check of that size going out of his bank balance.
It costs up to 20 times more to fight a libel case in the UK than it does in the EU, you say in the book. Why is that?
You don't have all these sort of preliminary skirmishes, the endless discovery. Cases tend to get resolved on paper and looking at statements, and you don't have these big show trials. I think that's something we should look at, really, because do you get better justice if millions have been spent on both sides? I don't think you do, because not everyone has millions to spend on litigation. So it inevitably favours the rich. What people basically want is a decision. I mean, obviously, when a decision is made, there is likely to be one party who is not happy, but they're going to be less unhappy if they're not totally ruined by it. I mean, if a skilled judge says, I'm very sorry, but I prefer the other side's account, and I think you did go too far in what you said, even if you did do it in good faith, that's a much easier state of affairs for them. And I think people want cheap and swift justice rather than lengthy justice, which in the end they just have to drop out of.
And the sheer scale of the fees involved and the liability of journalists if it's ruled that they've got their facts wrong or have libeled someone, it has a massive chilling effect, doesn't it, effectively? I mean, there are people who newspapers and organisations just won't go after because they're so litigious. Often the public doesn't know that, but they will not go near them because they are so litigious that it is simply too risky.
Well, that's really the iceberg under the surface. I mean, when Aaron Banks brought his action against Carol Cadwalader, there had been, up to that time, a number of quite critical articles about Mr. Banks, but those stopped abruptly. Carol Cadwalader was left taking on this battle, which has probably cost her and her supporters, because she got crowdfunding support, probably a couple of million pounds, because what quite often happens in these cases, I mean, the judge, in fairness to Mr. Banks, did say that it wasn't a slap action. But in cases like that, you do find that people are suing individual journalists, and it's an unequal battle. And one of the things I'm arguing for is that the courts should really weigh up our interest, the public's interest in the right to have this information, against the damage that would be done to the claimant if he was not allowed to bring his claim.
What do you personally think of the lawyers who will work for clients like, say, Yevgeny Prigozhin?
Well, I think people should be asking themselves, is it right? If one is a lawyer, one tends not to be acting throughout your career for sainted, benighted people. And people are entitled to their day in court. But I think it's really a question of the regulatory authorities and also changes in the SLAPP law. I think until that happened. Well, the regulatory authorities have made some changes, but until anti-SLAPP law comes in, it's a bit difficult to criticise the lawyers.
What needs to change most urgently? Is it the law itself that needs to change to create a more level playing field, as you were saying, between the claimants and the defendants? Or is it the incentives that exist in the UK for rich people to sue? Or is it a combination of both?
I think it's really a combination of both. And libel actions are rather different to... I mean, if Mr. Berezovsky and Mr. Abramovich are slogging it out over a contract, well, that really affects only them. And I mean, it's up to the courts to hear the evidence and decide it. But once it's libel, first of all, you have the burden of proof falling on the defendant, and it's extremely. I mean, I can speak from personal experience with the Berezovsky case. It's very difficult to get people to come and give evidence against somebody whose opponents had a very nasty habit of ending up dead. And the other aspect of it is that, unlike a purely contractual dispute or a dispute over property, I mean, there is a public interest, but we're entitled to know about these people. We're entitled to know about whether Mr. Zahawi has been paying his tax.
You had a bodyguard when you were defending against Boris Berezovsky. Have you ever feared for your life in the course of your work as a lawyer?
No, I haven't at all. I've always been willing to take people on. And one is very lucky to live in a country where there is a degree of security, although, unfortunately, a very great many people in the Berezovsky case did end up getting murdered. Our client got murdered, and the two claimants got murdered, and they were both murdered in this country.
And Berezovsky himself is dead and may well have been murdered.
Berezovsky was almost certainly murdered.
Yes. You yourself, though, have been sued for libel in Greece at the moment. Is that case still going on?
Yes, it is. But everything moves very slowly in Greece. But that I view as a slap action. I was being sued for evidence I gave in the Greek Supreme Court, which is would be an entirely legitimate activity in this country.
So it may, you know, grad grind style, just perhaps not. It may never come to trial.
Yes, he's the second person who has tried to get me thrown in jail. Mr. Fyde was the first, and that didn't succeed. So I think I shall continue to holiday in Greece.
Well, let's hope that you can. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Buying Silence is published by Biteback. And you can support The Bunker by searching Patreon Bunker Podcast and contributing just £3 a month if you want to. I'm Ros Taylor, and thanks for listening.
The Bunker was presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Chris Jones. Audio production was from me, Robin Leeburn. Our music's by Kenny Dickinson. And assistant production by Adam Wright. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. Group editor, Andrew Harrison. And The Bunker is a Podmasters production.